The Guardian.
Mark Edmondson, why read?
Why read? Well, the compressed answer is to change your life, to make it a little bit better than it is.
How does reading change your life?
Well, the way I like to put it is this, that we all get socialized one time around by parents and teachers and schools and priests and ministers and what have you.
Hello and welcome to A Neuroscientist Explains. I'm Daniel Glazer, and I identify as a neuroscientist. Right now, I'm director of Science Gallery London, which is part of King's College London.
They find themselves disgruntled, dissatisfied by even what the best meaning teachers and parents say. Those people go a lot of different directions, but one of the best directions they can go is to become obsessed readers.
And for just over 2 years, I wrote a weekly column in The Observer magazine, wherein I explored the world of culture and topical events through the eyes of a neuroscientist.
They got a second set of parents and a second set of teachers, and they can start seeing the world for themselves.
So in season two of this podcast, we're going to revisit some of those columns and explore the neuroscience within them at greater depth. And this week, we'll be looking at what goes on in the brain when we're reading words.
Words do have strong associations with sounds, and you can see that in the brain in most paradigms, but it depends what you're doing with the objects. As you learn to read and you become more familiar with it, you become more efficient at it, you become better at recognising particular features, and so it becomes less work for your brain.
Because there was in what was that newspaper called? The Guardian, that's right. That was last thing at the weekend.
As you all know by now, each episode begins with a single conversation between me.
So, Dan, it's our final episode of season two.
And producer Max. It's not that I didn't think we were going to make it. I was always optimistic. But it's good. I think I feel like we've pulled it off, Max. And again, you know, lest anyone be under the illusion that, you know, this banter where we're sort of working out what we're doing as we go along is some sort of facade. Mm. We genuinely did pump them out one per week without really having a clue what we were doing at the beginning or indeed from week to week. I mean, to take a case in point, we're talking about an article this week and we've got no idea who we're going to get to speak to about the topic.
And on top of that, I mean, you say we pump out one a week. Dan, before we sat down and started recording this, informed me that he's going on holiday for 10 days. So we're actually going to do two this week. Yes. They'll come out consecutive weeks.
We wouldn't want to overwhelm people. But
yeah. No, it was a nice, you know, we've been talking about dates for a long time now, and it is the week before, and Dan decides to tell me he's going for 10 days. Hey ho! It's all part of Jeopardy, right?
Absolutely. No, this column is one of the early ones, and I think it's actually quite a cheesy one, if I'm honest. You know, the story was that some hapless sign painter had painted up some really large billboard signs, and what he'd written on them was, "Chris is risen," right?
Which is strange because it's coming up to Easter.
Because it is coming up to Easter. In fact, you know what? Don't tell me. Did you actually choose this thing because it was an Easter? No, you didn't. Okay, good. That would have
Yes, I did.
So it was an Easter message within the Christian religion. The understanding is that at Easter, it's the time when Christ is first strung up and then taken down and then rises. And he painted "Chris is risen" instead of "Christ is risen." And I suppose the point of the news story and the musing for me was, how can this be? How could somebody have done such a thing? And the answer is pretty obviously that he just didn't read it. I mean, he was writing and didn't read it. And Max, as a, you know, visual neuroscientist, I'm very interested in how we see the world. And in the column, actually, and again, you can search it up online, I did type in, which was kind of hilarious, actually, that you'll have seen it online, this bit where it's a sentence where all the letters of each word are jumbled up, but you can still make sense of it. I'm just looking now what we wrote. The sentence says, which means it's still possible to understand I can't read that word now, so which rather undermines it. Understand a phrase. Thank you. A phrase written like this. Turns out phrase is harder to read than I thought. And there's something really interesting about the fact that although we think what we're doing is putting the letters together to make words when we read, it turns out, like a lot of stuff that we've talked about, that our own model of what we're doing when we read is incorrect. And actually, it seems as if the letter at the beginning of the word and the letter at the end of the word and the shape of the word are what we're using to read. And if you study eye movements, then it seems quite likely that that's what's happening. You kind of jump around when you're reading. But altogether, I'm just really curious, and it's something which is at the edge of my neuroscientific knowledge, which is always the most exciting place to be. Curious to know what's actually happening in your brain when you do this funny visual process of reading.
And I'm so excited about this, Dan. So this is a moment I've been waiting for. It's at the edge of your scientific, I mean, I feel like my whole scientific thing is just exists at edges by this point. But as you may remember, Dan, many moons ago, I did a neuroscience degree. Within that neuroscience degree, I had to write a dissertation. And let me tell you something, that dissertation happened to be very closely related to what we're talking about.
It's the smuggest I've ever seen you look, Max. If you can see his little face, he's so proud of it.
I mean, it's smug slash terrified, because this is now I've sort of laid down the gauntlet and said, this is stuff I know about, and I'm probably going to say it all wrong. But
and this week we've chosen to speak to expert Max Sanderson.
No, please.
Max, what is going on in the brain when you read?
Well, so my dissertation project was, I think I've said this before, I wasn't very good in the lab. So I stayed away from that. But I didn't really want to do a research project because I thought it was just a little bit boring. So I sort of picked something in between. So it ended up being a meta-analysis. And the topic that I was looking at in this meta-analysis was an area of the brain called the visual word form area. Or VWFA.
VWFA, which doesn't spell anything if I'm doing it in my head when you try and read the VWFA.
VWFA. Yeah, that's what we called it in the lab, the VWFA. If I remember correctly, it was kind of on the left side, just behind your ear, slightly above it. And basically what this, like I said, I did my dissertation on it, so I'm going to pull a direct quote from my dissertation. Supposedly, this VWFA is selectively tuned to sublexical orthographic features of a word.
So sublexical means smaller than a word.
Yeah.
And orthographic means to do with how it's written down.
Yeah, so the orthographic are kind of a set of rules for a given language which the words of that language abide by. So it's essentially the rules of language. So the way that they looked at this in most studies is they get kind of triplets of letters. And they're nonsense. They don't mean anything. But some of them abide by orthographic principles and some of them don't. They look at what happens when someone in the scanner is reading those things. And what this sort of group found, so there was kind of two groups that my dissertation was looking at. And the group who are pushing the visual word form area, what they supposedly found is that when you've got someone in the scanner and they're reading these triplets of nonsense words, if the words abide by these orthographic rules, then this area, the VWFA, lights up.
What were you trying to compare in your meta-analysis when you were looking at all these other papers and trying to work out what the consensus was? What were you trying to find?
Basically, the reason we wanted to do a meta-analysis is because there's two opposing groups. So there's the group that I've already mentioned who says the visual word form area exists.
You were like the United Nations of brain research.
Yeah, I was trying to mediate between
truth
the
and
two
reconciliation
groups. Exactly. So you have the group that says that the VWFA exists and it is activated selectively for these sublexical orthographic features. So that's what they said. And then you had this other group that basically just said, no, it's a load of rubbish. And they're not saying that it doesn't light up, as far as I remember. But I think they're saying that it's not selective for that. They basically talk about it as more of a meeting point between, say, the bottom-up sensory information you get when you're reading a word and the top-down kind of language processing. And there's nothing in the actual area specifically that is tuned to these kind of orthographic regulations. Actually, what it is this kind of meeting point. And the other thing they say, as far as I can remember, is it's not just for visual words. So it can be activated by other things. But the interesting thing in the evolutionary sense is that on the right-hand side, there is, so I said that the visual word form area is lateralized to the left. So on the right-hand side, its kind of counterpart on the right side of the brain is an area called the fusiform face area, which is seemingly tuned so the neurons are activated when we see faces.
Do you miss science, Max?
Well, I do now, yeah, after talking about it. I miss being able to, that was for me one of the most enjoyable experiences of university, when you can really dig into something and you, I mean, I wasn't an expert, but you kind of feel like one, and you get into the intricacies of it. I suppose I enjoyed my university experience a lot, but the bits that I didn't particularly enjoy is the fact that it's all very transient and you study for an exam and then it's on to the next one, whereas this was, I felt like a proper scientist.
Yeah. So good, Max. It's lovely to hear that your reminiscences of your time in science are of a positive nature. And let's see if we can put some flesh onto those half-remembered bones.
That's like Richard Wiseman's stuff about lucky people finding more fibres in the street than unlucky people.
Definitely.
Yeah, that's true.
Hi, Kathy.
And luckily for me, although maybe not so luckily for producer Max, I know just the person.
I'm Kathy Price, and I'm the director of the Wellcome Centre for Human Neuroimaging.
Kathy is also a friend and former colleague of mine, who knows all about the visual word form area.
Kind of the anatomy of it.
But more of that later.
Neuroscience of it, what we think's going on. And I guess the simple question to start with is...
Best to start with some basics.
If you think about what's going on in the brain or what the processes are, is reading words fundamentally different from looking at pictures or looking at other kinds of thing in the world?
It's different. I'm not sure I'd say it was fundamentally different. It's different because words have got very strong associations of sounds with them. So when you look at a word, you're trained to think about the speech that's associated with the letters that you're looking at. Whereas when you look at an object, the first thing you do is get to the meaning, what is it? So that there's a very old paper by Glaser, actually. Glaser and Glaser, not you. Not you, but that paper has been cited probably hundreds, thousands of times, indicating that pictures are very faster to get to the meaning of what the picture is, the semantics of it, whereas with words you're faster to get to the sound. So that's a key distinction. But other than that, both of them involve, 99% the same processes. You're looking at visual features, you're trying to extract the meaning, and you're trying to associate that with sound. And if you're reading aloud, then in both cases you will be producing the speech sounds that are associated with them.
So, like, historically, I'm a visual neuroscientist, and so I kind of have a fairly clear idea of the anatomy of the visual system, and we know that there are different bits of the visual system that are tuned in to different aspects of the world, be that movement or depth or colour or stereo and so on. And I guess then for seeing, as it were, what I'm going to call normal scenes, not that seeing words is abnormal, you sort of would have some combination of those areas being activated. But is it the case, following from your point about sounds, that when you read words silently, areas of the brain which are usually processing sounds get automatically activated?
Yes, that would be the case. And, well, you started your question by talking about the visual system and what you're familiar with. And what's interesting about looking at words is they will activate a subset of those regions. So one clear, maybe surprising distinction is that there's not a region of the brain that's more active in the visual system for seeing written words than seeing pictures. Most of the visual system is less activated, particularly in the right hemisphere, is less activated for looking at written words than pictures. But words do have strong associations with sounds, and you can see that in the brain in most paradigms, but it depends what you're doing with the objects. So if people are just looking at them, or they're saying, what is their meaning, or is this a real thing or not a real thing, then you will see clear differences where there's areas that are more active for the written words than for the pictures. But if you ask them, will name the pictures, and you force them then to get to the sounds, then you'll have as much activation for the pictures as you do for the words.
Is there any extra area that reading really activates, or have you basically got the same system?
Well, it's always differential activation. So, yeah, there are parts, the speaking areas can be more active during reading, but it is actually quite variable, so it wouldn't be every single experiment. It would probably depend on how high or low frequency the words were, or whether they were, they were long words. or short words. So those things might differentiate what the demands on the speaking areas are, and that might vary for words and for pictures. Because for words, if you've got a long word, you've got to assemble all the sounds. So that assembly of the sounds from the different components of the letters can take more time and increase the activation in the speaking regions, compared to when you see a picture of an elephant. Even though it's a long word, it comes straight out as one is elephant, so it comes out as a sort of whole lexical item, as opposed to what we say sublexical processing, which is involved in the words.
I mean, again, Kathy, you know me long enough to kick me when I'm asking stupid questions, but like, I guess I'm remembering now why, as a visual neuroscientist, I never got interested in reading. Because every time I ask you a question about the visual areas implicated in reading and are different when you're reading words and other things, you give me a story about a non-visual area. Right? So I keep asking you about what's the difference in seeing words, and you say, well, the speaking area does this and the meaning area does that. And so this is the stupid question. If you think about the changes in your brain that happen as a result of learning to read, are you saying actually that in terms of the visual system, you're not doing much different when you're reading, or there's not much difference in your brain having learned to read? It's really about non-visual areas and how they're linked to visual areas. That's what you're training up when you're learning to read.
Well, it's both. So if you would like me to talk about the visual areas,
this is your place. You're literally the director. You get to talk about absolutely anything.
I would like to talk about the visual areas. Okay. So with the visual areas, what's interesting, and it's one of the first things I said, is it's a subset of the visual areas. So there aren't any visual areas that are there for special visual features of words, because we've made words out of object-type shapes that we see all the time. What happens when you learn to read is that as you learn to read and you become more familiar with it, you become more efficient at it, you become better at recognizing particular features, and so it becomes less work for your brain. It becomes tuned in, so the amount of activation in the visual system gets reduced and reduced and reduced and reduced until you're down to the core regions and features that are necessary to link that up with the non-visual speech areas.
So despite producer Max's traumatic flashbacks to his undergraduate dissertation and the visual word form area, Kathy isn't taking the bait. Rather, the picture that Kathy is painting is one in which the visual system relays information from the eyes, but it's other areas of the brain that seem to get excited about reading. So maybe producer Max is remembering it all wrong. We'll find out after this short break.
What this region is an interactive region. It interacts with the language system.
And we'll also ask Kathy about another brain area that pops up in producer Max's recollection. The fusiform face area.
Is it dedicated to faces? Well, there's a whole literature out there which says it's not dedicated to faces, but something about faces taps the processing in that area.
We'll be right back.
Welcome to The Start, a brand new weekly podcast from The Guardian.
Without those kind of engaging with reality, I will not become I worry today.
Each episode reveals a story of artistic beginnings, as told by some of the great artists of our time.
For me, Scandalicious, so much of that was also about me finding my way.
Focusing on one piece, they share how these early moments of creativity shaped them, the influence it had on their subsequent work, and what the piece now means to them in retrospect.
The most I've ever seen in any room, you know, looking at any kind of art, was in Mr. Barnes's two rooms.
To find out more, head over to theguardian.com/podcasts or search The Start on your favourite podcast app.
Welcome back to A Neuroscientist Explains. I'm Daniel Glaser. Before the break, we were talking with Kathy Price, and she's an expert in how our brain achieves the incredible feat of reading. We heard that when it comes to reading, the visual system acts like a relay, passing on information to other areas in the brain that specialise in language. A process that gets better and more effortless as we learn to read. Before that, though, we revisited producer Max's undergraduate dissertation, which concerned the so-called visual word form area. Based on her earlier answers, this is not something Kathy holds in high regard.
And it's probably become
sort of... In fact, hilariously, Kathy turns out to be the author of a paper, well, actually, four of them, that producer Max referenced in his dissertation, the details of which he has obviously forgotten.
We discovered when we were looking up for people to potentially interview that I think I might have actually read a paper of yours for my dissertation that was looking into the visual word form area. So I've not looked into it for, you know, 7 or 8 years. Briefly, in your own words, what is the visual word form area, and is it actually a thing, or is it, I don't know, is it completely theoretical?
Right, and also, can I just add to that question? So this bit when I was trying to tease out the bits of the visual system that are specific for reading, and this wasn't a setup because I'd forgotten about the name of this area. Surely if there's an area called the visual word form area, that would be exactly what I was looking for, Kathy, which is the bit of the visual system that's specially about reading, never mind sounds and all that stuff. Go on, what is this area?
That the paper you might have read is called The Myth of the Visual Word Form Area.
Yes, you didn't say that, did you? That's right. Good.
So, I did not mention that there's an area of the brain that's specialised for reading. I did absolutely the opposite. And I get... You've set me up here. You set me up to get highly irritated. I remember the day when I read the second paper about the visual word form area, and I literally sat down and wrote this tirade of all the reasons why this paper wasn't correct. And it has taken 10 years to really, I think, get our point across in a way that might be the most popular view now.
Okay.
So the idea was that if you compare reading to looking at objects, you see more activation in some regions. And that's because reading, as I've said, is closely aligned to the language areas. And parts of the visual cortex are more active. Well, not really the visual cortex, but the visual association regions. And in this case, this is a region in the left occipital, ventral occipital temporal cortex.
So sort of it's adjacent to an area which we would properly think of as visual, but not in it.
Yes, that's right. And this region in the ventral occipital temporal cortex is activated when you have to name things. It's activated when you are touching something and you've got your eyes closed. So it's not a visual area, but it is activated when you're trying to name things. So I had already done some work with Christian Buechel and Carl Friston with blind, congenitally blind people that were naming items and they were touching them and activating this region. So when papers started coming out saying this region was a visual word form area and it was dedicated to visual word form processing, then I tried to list out all the other things that activated this region. And the response to that was, well, you know, we haven't got enough spatial resolution. So within this area, there were probably some neuronal populations that were more active for words than for objects. And then in a series of experiments, I think by us and by many other people, I think we have shown that that's highly unlikely to be the case. But what this region is an interactive region. It interacts with the language system.
Right.
And words are one of the things where you link the visual and the sensory system with the language regions.
I mean, I've got no problem.
So, just to clarify, producer Max did remember correctly that Kathy appeared in his dissertation. What he forgot is the extent to which she appeared.
The other thing that Max said...
As Max said in the studio, his meta-analysis looked at arguments between two different groups. It turns out, though, that Kathy, alongside her colleague Joseph Devlin, was the other group. And as Kathy points out, their argument against the idea of a visual word form area shows that this part of the brain is not selective for written language, but is also involved in a myriad of other tasks. It acts as a link between the areas of the brain involved in language and the sensory input. We've got to give producer Max credit for laying it on the line.
Let's face it, my old postdoc advisor had that.
But what about the other claim he made regarding a certain face area of the brain? So is that right at all, that there's a sort of counterpart in the non-verbal bit of the brain to the bit of the brain that sees words, which is specialised for seeing faces, or did we get that wrong? By we, I mean Max.
And you.
I was just listening and then relaying this to a world-famous professor to see if he was wrong or not.
Yes, so there's the left ventral occipital temporal cortex, and there are very specific parts of it, so you can actually look at the sulcus, and it's in the occipital temporal sulcus. That part is more activated for written words than, say, checkerboards. And if you look in the right counterpart, actually, it's not quite the exact homologue, but it's in a right region in the ventral occipital temporal cortex. Right fusiform. There's a region that is more active for when you're looking at faces than when you're looking at animals. And
I thought that, yes, by the way. I always thought Max was right about that. Yeah.
So it is more active. But again, is it dedicated to faces? Well, there's a whole literature out there which says it's not dedicated to faces, but something about faces taps the processing in that area. And probably it's about how that region integrates global and local features that are specific to faces.
Gotcha.
And how we integrate them.
And I mean, already in this podcast series, we've done some stuff with Robin Dunbar about evolution of the brain. And so, but it would be clear, wouldn't it, that language and writing almost certainly didn't come about in evolutionarily specific, you know, time. So what's probably happened is that there are areas of the brain that have evolved for seeing detailed things that are important to us, like faces, where we have to relate local and global features and where it's really important to identify them. And in a sense, the development of reading has sort of piggybacked on those kinds of areas and has used them for a purpose for which they were not originally evolved, if you can talk about purpose and evolution. Yes. Would that be right?
Yes, and I think everybody would agree with that. I mean, even the people who introduce the visual word form area and talk about the face area, they all agree that reading is late in the evolutionary process and it will be adapting the brain. The difference would be is just how much does it adapt the brain? You know, is it changing the function of the region itself so that it was originally, as a kid, you're using it for objects, and then as you grow older and you learn to read, you then use it for reading more than you use it for objects? Or is it the case that, no, it has exactly the same function, it's got the same inputs, the same outputs, and you are just using it more when you're reading? That's probably the more debated issue now. Does the region change, or is it just used in a different way? Yeah, one way of testing that is to look to see what happens in adults who learn to read, what changes in their brain. So we did a study in collaboration with Manolo Caresas and showed that what changed when adults were learning to read was the angular gyrus and the corpus callosum and areas that were sort of linking the two hemispheres together. And it wasn't in the visual word form area.
Wherever you look, you're surrounded by words. We don't even notice them because we're so used to them. But they are all trying to tell us something, communicate some sort of a message. The message can be the name.
So it would seem producer Max unwittingly reopened a can of worms for Kathy, a whole 6 years after he completed his dissertation.
In fact, our lives are ruled by words. Words made up of those 26 symbols, which are the letters of our alphabet.
And interestingly, these kinds of disputes crop up in brain science all the time. Some would say that the concept of narrow specialization of a brain area is a hangover from the phrenology of previous centuries, and it's being challenged across the board. Liberating neuroscience from this simplistic view of brain function allows researchers like Kathy to examine the brain as a much more dynamic, coherent, and synergistic organ. Anyway, back to this week's column. So the hook for the article this week was, actually, funnily enough, it must have been a year, maybe 2 years ago, around Easter time, and there was a story we saw where this hapless sign painter had been hired by his local church to write an Easter message, like big signboard message. And what he'd done is he'd written, "Chris is risen," right? Big letters, you know? And so all this stuff you were talking about, fluency and words you know and reading quickly and skipping over letters and all that stuff, sure. But how come, if we're so good at reading, this guy could do it in, you know, 3-foot-high letters and look at it, you know, 4 or 5 times to check it and then call the vicar in and kind of go, "So what do you think?" And the vicar's like, "What have you done?" And he's like, "What do you mean, what have I done?" And then he sees it. How can it be that we can sometimes be so rubbish at reading, even big letters, even slowly?
That sounds like we're coming back to the puzzle again that irritates you, because in that case, there's the last word that's been missed off, the last letter that's been missed off. So it's a very obvious error. But how can we be so rubbish? I mean, in that case, he won't have been writing it. When we write very fast, and we will have some sort of template that we've got to complete it. We have to start with a C and we have to end with a T when we're writing Christ. Mm-hmm. Whereas for him, he would have done everything painstakingly slowly. I don't know how he managed to lift up the T. But we're very different. I mean, you would rarely do that when you were writing if you were a skilled writer.
True. Mm. It's a nice Easter message anyway,
yes,
isn't it, Max?
Yes, Chris is risen. Yeah, it's good.
The letters of our alphabet are the basic currency of civilization. They enable us to store up information and to communicate over time and distance.
After all that, it might have had more to do with writing than reading. But I suppose you can't have one without the other.
Modern letters were once no more than primitive pictures. They grew thousands of years ago out of a basic instinct of man to make his mark.
Special thanks this week to Kathy Price. This episode of A Neuroscientist Explains was presented by me, Daniel Glazer, and the producer was Max Sanderson. We'd love to hear what you think, so please do send any thoughts, feedback, or neuroscience queries to aneuroexplains, all one word, @gmail.com. That's season 2 all done and dusted. Thanks to all our contributors and to you, our lovely listeners. All that's left to say is, see you again in season 3.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.